Hi, everyone. This is America Adapts, the climate change podcast. Hey, adapters. Welcome back to an exciting episode. Joining me is Dr. Justin Mankin, a climate scientist and associate professor at Dartmouth College. Justin wrote a provocative and fascinating article in the New York Times about climate data. Most of the climate data is generated by government entities and therefore is considered a public good and service. Private firms, some of which I've covered in this podcast, have increasingly tapped into this climate data to provide climate modeling services. Justin argues we should consider climate data like this a public good and make it available for adaptation planning for free. It's a fascinating discussion, and we dig into what it means to privatize this information. We also discuss the need for a national adaptation plan, and we learn some of the important work his students are doing in the climate modeling space. I promised that I would cover climate modeling more, and here we go. We dig into many of the ethical issues that are quickly arising. We all need to have these conversations as governments and the private sector increasingly turn to this climate data for adaptation planning. Before we get started, let's talk about us all going to New York City. And that means attending the 2024 Waterfront Conference. This fantastic event is hosted by the Waterfront Alliance, a U.S.-based nonprofit organization with over 1,100 partners. This conference is all about real change for our waterfronts and coastlines. Now in its 17th year, the Waterfront Conference has become the go-to forum for discussing and strategizing on the challenges faced by our entire nation. If you go, and I hope you do, you'll be joining over 600 participants, including policymakers, community leaders, scientists, engineers, architects, academics, environmental advocates, and professionals from labor, real estate, insurance, and finance sectors. And yes, podcasters will be there. The event explores everything from climate change solutions to sustaining robust coastal economies, ensuring equitable access to our waterfronts and waterways, and fostering a healthier open space environment. I'm very excited to be participating in the Waterfront Conference. I'll be there moderating sessions, participating in the breakouts, and hopefully meeting all of you who participate. It's happening May 21st, 2024, from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York City. And they are offering something special for my listeners, a 10% discount on your tickets. Just use the code AMERICA at checkout. Plus, there are special rates for students and nonprofits. So whether you're a policy junkie like me, an environmental advocate, or just someone who cares about the future of our planet, this conference is for you. For more information on the Waterfront Conference and the incredible work of the Waterfront Alliance, head over to waterfrontalliance.org. Links are in my show notes. Guys, it's New York City. I shall be returning to this incredible Persian restaurant I went to in the East Village a few years ago. Join me. Okay, hopefully I'll see you there. All right, let's join Dr. Justin Mankin and talk about climate data as a public good. Hey, adapters. Welcome back to a very exciting episode. Joining me is Dr. Justin Mankin. Justin is a climate scientist and associate professor in the Department of Geography at Dartmouth College. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
I love talking to professors. And so why we are talking is I actually read this provocative column that you wrote for the New York Times. And we're going to get to that. We're going to get to the contents of that. But it was just a fascinating article. And then you and I had a pre-recording call where we were able to dig a bit more about things that we can talk about. But first, I want to ground my listeners. What do you do there at Dartmouth?
I run the Climate Modeling and Impacts Group here at Dartmouth College, which I established in 2018 when I started on the faculty. Our group is really motivated by what a world with global warming looks like and trying to do the accounting that clarifies what that world looks like, understanding what the impacts of climate change mean for all the things we value, our food, our water, our well-being economically, and from a kind of a health perspective. And a lot of our work kind of historically has been prospective, thinking about what the future looks like. And increasingly what we've started to turn to is more retrospective analyses where we're actually doing the documentation of what climate impacts have wrought and understanding the genesis of those impacts and really doing a rigorous documentation of their impacts.
You've explained a little bit of it here, but you're a climate scientist. And I had Dr. Catherine Hayhoe on once before, and I think I referred to her as a climatologist, and she corrected me and said she's a climate scientist. Could you just elaborate a bit more what it means to be a climate scientist versus, let's say, a climatologist?
Yeah, I laugh because my PhD advisor loved to make that correction too. And it's something that's really shaped my understanding of what we do as distinct from climatology, which I think has its origins in deep roots in geography, which is kind of the statistical analysis of weather, right? Climatologists, my advisor, Noah Diffenbaugh, used to say is somebody who likes to take 30 numbers, add them together and divide by 30, right? Kind of characterizing long-term weather in a location. A climate scientist, and there are many definitions, and I think what constitutes climate science as a domain of inquiry is really expanding rapidly, can include all components of the Earth system and how that shapes climate or how climate shapes those particular elements of the Earth system, whether it's the cryosphere or the ocean, the land surface, or the atmosphere itself. I kind of think of it much more as an Earth system's characterization of climate.
Fantastic. And again, before we get to the paper and all the topics that we're going to cover in there, I want to ground my listeners in some fundamentals first. And so a lot of them have been exposed to this concept of climate models, climate data in previous episodes, but not all of them. And I'm just, if you could give us that 30,000 foot view, what is a climate model? And I'll be interested if maybe your definition is a little bit different from maybe I've had some policy experts come on and talk about climate models.
I think of a climate model as a theory of climate. The power of a model is that it forces you to formalize relationships among a system, to do diagnosis and create understanding. It's a way of communicating expertise to non-experts, provides the ability for forecasts or predictions under some conditions, right? So modeling as an exercise is really pretty varied. I think climate model is often a theory of climate that's formalized as a computer program. And so what we're talking about when we're talking about modern day Earth system models, like the ones that inform the climate assessments undergirding the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, those models are really sophisticated computer programs that are increasingly national scale endeavors. They're kind of the scope of building them and running them and interrogating them is beyond what could be pursued by any one research group. That's all exploded in just in terms of the number of people involved. And so they're national scale investments at this point, kind of the most sophisticated climate models. That said, a theory of climate can take a host of forms, from a zero dimensional energy balance model to a model of reduced complexity, like the finite amplitude impulse response model that's come out of the UK, that's actually become really important in scenario generation. But the ones your listeners are probably most thinking of are these Earth system models, which are really representing the fully coupled nature of the Earth system from its atmosphere to the ocean, to the cryosphere, to the land surface, to the dynamic interactions in terms of energy and biogeochemistry, kind of governing the dynamics of that system and therefore of the climate that we experience. A climate model is a model of the climate system. It is a simplification of the climate system so that we can probe it and run experiments with it, given that we can't conduct experiments on our Earth itself. You could argue we're conducting an uncontrolled one right now. But yeah, the model is a computer program in order to conduct experiments and generate understanding.
We're going to talk about this article that you wrote, this column that was fantastic. And the title of the column was "The People Have a Right to Climate Data." And that in itself is a bold statement. And you don't necessarily have to get into the specifics of everything it covers, but what inspired you to write the column?
Yeah, the inspiration was kind of I think a few things coalesced in order to kind of inspire me to sit down and write this. I wrote an original draft in December of 2022 after hearing a lecture from a really wonderful, prominent scientist in my field, Adam Sobel, who's, I think, been at the forefront of both documenting how scientists think about their science around climate change in the form of his really wonderful podcast, Deep Convection, which I'd encourage all America Adapt listeners to go and check out. I think Adam, he was giving this very prestigious lecture called the Charney Lecture at the American Geophysical Union meeting in 2022. And he was talking about the rise of climate risk science as a domain of inquiry, as something that people are studying, but mostly from the private sector side of things. And he was talking about the work, which his work is a lot on the tropics, and in particular tropical hazards like Hurricane Genesis and tropical cyclones. He was talking about how he had been working with the reinsurance industry. So these are the insurance conglomerates that insure the insurers. And it makes sense that the reinsurance industry would be a major employer of geoscientists, given that insurance is in part about hedging the economic costs of hazards, whether those are kind of earth hazards like earthquakes or atmospheric ones like hurricanes. He was just mentioning how far ahead the reinsurance and kind of private risk industry was in terms of trying to interrogate and characterize the risks that climate change poses to people and our well-being. And he was making a call for just more work in the academy to be done, right, by professors like me to understand what climate risks portend and how to understand them and how to get that information into the hands of people that can then act on it, right? How do we inform the decisions that climate change necessitates? I went home from that talk both inspired, but also I wanted more clarity on, okay, well, what's the public role in something like this, right? If climate risk science is just the province of the private sector, what does that mean for who's left behind? And the other kind of factor that had been happening is that in my group, we've been doing a lot of documentation of climate impacts to date. We live in a world where global warming has occurred and it's hurt people. And given data, we can go and start to do that interrogation and figure out the genesis and consequences of climate hazards. So we've been doing that work. And in doing so, we found that the costs of climate change are far higher than we previously understood, particularly in terms of how it's impacting our economic well-being. We also found that our ability to document that has been limited by data availability. And so there's kind of an inherent spotlight effect. And so there's this embedded inequity in the causes and consequences of global warming, in that the people most vulnerable to global warming are enduring its impacts first. Those are the same places and people that are arguably least culpable for global warming. They are also the places where we're least able to document those impacts, right? They're data poor places with vulnerable people enduring climate impacts. And therefore, we're kind of least well prepared to develop meaningful interventions to mitigate the risks of climate impacts. I had been seeing that kind of quadruple whammy of kind of the tragic inequity embedded in global warming in my own work. I had heard Adam's call for kind of greater investment in academic kind of public sector science to think about climate risk science as a legitimate domain of inquiry. And just, I was like, well, somebody needs to say that it's a public good and make that case why it is that private firms profiting from public climate science could maybe be putting people at risk. And I sat down and I wrote an original draft of it that I think was pretty down on the private sector. I think it was maybe a bit unfair. And so I sat on it for about a year. And then I finally had some time this past fall and dusted it off, particularly because I had been contacted by a bunch of folks in private investment and in reinsurance about papers that I had published where they were looking for my results. And they wanted me to help them understand what my results implied for their businesses and have me help them draw out those implications, presumably so that they could turn around and use that science and repackage it potentially for clients for sale. And so that kind of created a moral ambiguity for me. And so I was inspired to kind of pick up the piece again and redraft it with a slightly honed argument and sent it into this editor at the New York Times who I'd worked with in the past.
Okay, I think it's really interesting. And can you share the anecdote within the column about AccuWeather and the railroad company? Really quickly, but just, I thought that was just an incredible real life example of what could potentially really create some resentment out there.
Yeah, the friend of mine actually pointed me to that example. So that wasn't something I just happened to watch that CNBC interview. But essentially, the anecdote I presented was about the fact that AccuWeather, which is a commercial weather company that leverages both publicly available data produced by the National Weather Service, which is under the aegis of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The CEO of AccuWeather was in an interview with CNBC and essentially touted this story. And I guess he's told this story more than once, but he essentially tells a story of how they warned a rail company, which had been a paid subscriber to their highly tailored weather forecasts, of a tornado that was about to strike and present a risk to a train. That they were moving across Tornado Alley. And their weather forecast actually saved a derailment, right? They stopped the train, as he tells the story, and the tornado passed between the two trains, essentially. But they didn't actually provide any warning, that same warning, to a nearby town. That town didn't have a paid subscription to the tailored forecasts that the train company did. And that resulted in the death of 12 people, right? And that's one weather report. And the thing I kind of posit is, how might that play out over assessments of climate risk writ large, right? Where you have haves and have nots, and you're just kind of reinforcing latent inequities embedded in society and deepening them, right? Where towns that are not paid subscribers are enduring losses, and those that have the resources to pay for subscriptions that can help them manage climate risks, maybe they're better off.
And I'm not expecting you to have a position on this, but I just kind of just imagine, as the climate data gets more accurate in modeling, I mean, that's a very specific kind of like, wow, we were able to avoid this damage to the railroad, but just the fact that the town got hit and the legal implications of it. And I just wonder what legal precedent, if like someone is going to go do something dangerous and you don't warn anybody about it, is there legal precedent for that? These are things that probably need to start worrying about as this climate information gets more accurate. And I'm not having you implying that, I'm just speculating myself on like these potential problems. And so I want to pivot a little bit here. And you'd mentioned like these firms that reach out to you, like BlackRock, and they're asking you for your expertise. And you really make the point that you want this to be public information. I'm curious what that interaction was like, though. Is this someone from BlackRock? Is it a policy person? Is it someone who has technical skills? When they talk to you, maybe you don't want to use BlackRock example, but just more generally, how did that unfold? Is it just like, yeah, go take a look at the website? I mean, how did you kind of really walk through that?
Yeah, my science is funded by your tax dollars, Doug, right? And your listeners' tax dollars, right? I receive funding from the National Science Foundation, from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, from NASA, from the Department of Energy. And I go and I pursue my investigations, which are fundamentally about informing adaptation and risk management of climate change. That science is paid for. And to the extent that science is linked back to people's tax dollars, I have an absolute imperative to communicate my science to whoever will listen. And I feel that really, really deeply, which is why I say yes to talking to things like on a podcast, or anytime there's a media inquiry, I answer yes. Or anytime I'm invited to give a public lecture, I say sure. And that's because I think there is a real moral imperative that I have, given that people paid for that science, that it's theirs, and to share it. And that holds for when private companies reach out to me as well. Like, they deserve to understand what that science implies for them as a collective. And so I get emails, or sometimes people will cold call me and they'll ask about the analyses or the assumptions, or if I have follow-on analyses I'd be willing to share, or if there's code or data. And as part of the fact that our effort is funded by the public, we try to make those data accessible and reproducible. And that means that we work hard to publish our code and analyses and data, because that's also what's beneficial to the science. And I think it actually has some interactions with some of your questions about the liability attached to a lot of these private sector models that are being developed that are not subject to the same scrutiny or same kind of open calls. I I point them to where we archive the data and the analyses. And to the extent that they have the technical alacrity to do so, they can take it and add value to it for sure, and then repackage it and sell it to their clients if they want. I'm just not going to do that work for them. I also think that I'd be lying if I didn't say, like, if they don't add value to it and they're simply just casting my science for their clients in order to generate a profit, that's a bummer because their clients have already paid for that science. And they paid for it by paying taxes, which have supported the incredible work that's done by NSF and NOAA and DOE and NASA, NIH, public agencies on this issue.
Again, you've sort of answered this, but I'm going to ask it in this way too. And of course, I think I generally know where you're going to come from, but there seems to be a new climate tool presented at every conference, and it looks pretty good. And if it's a climate model and if it's free, and this is usually the case when there's government entities involved, wouldn't that just actually be a red flag for some people? Like a free climate model, is it actually worth as much as something that costs something? And again, I think your whole argument here is like, yes, I hope you see what I'm getting at, though, is that something that's free and doesn't have that sort of premium of, okay, we're going to really add all the bells and whistles, and that's going to cost you.
I think the climate models that have been built by national labs in the United States, those models, some of them are more community focused, like the ones out of the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Some of them are less public, but are less community focused, I guess I would say, like this model from NASA GIS in New York City, but are kind of equally important in informing the IPCC. Those models are technically out there. It just takes a tremendous amount of expertise and computational power in order to work with them and to run them and conduct experiments with them that would provide some resolution on questions you have. I think the other thing is that they operate at a spatial scale that is not commensurate with decisions. What does it mean to represent the amount of water volumetrically stored in the top centimeter of soils in a 100 by 100 kilometer grid box? And like, what does that value even mean? It's such an abstraction. Does that help you characterize drought in a place? I would argue that it doesn't. And so the value added is how we take those data and bring them down to spatiotemporal scales that are commensurate with like actual decisions being made by people, whether those are individuals or firms or municipalities or states or nations. The fact is that our experience and therefore adaptation to climate risks is going to be local. And so there's a fundamental spatiotemporal disconnect between what the scientific community provides when we're talking about climate models, at least in my discipline, and what we're talking about the needs of kind of the informational needs of adaptation. And so where the private sector, I think, has found a foothold is in thinking about how to take these coarser spatiotemporal data and bring them down to the spatial scales that are more relevant to decisions. The issue that I see there is that there's a huge amount of science and a huge number of scientific decisions that go into how it is that you take coarse data at 100 by 100 kilometer grid box and bring it down to, say, the level of a township or the level of a farm or the level of a watershed, right? I think there are some really important scientific choices. And I think the question is, well, how much should that be up to a profit-driven private sector versus which doesn't subject itself to the same scrutiny from the scientific community versus being generated in NOAA or in NASA or in DOE or wherever? Or that's kind of the thing that I'm concerned of there.
You did cover a lot of ground, and I still want to dig into that because I think of just even you in the article you mentioned, you refer to these people to even the climate modeling tools that you have at Dartmouth and then these national labs. And I've been involved when I used to work with government, like when we're creating a tool or something like that, there's this sort of brainstorming sessions. And most of the time people sit around, who is our audience? Who is this tool for? And I think of especially these big models, and they get these grants to develop it, but maybe something's lost in that process that you need. You just described you need high technical skills to maybe even understand it. But then you get to the point at the end of the day, why are we building this and who are we building it for? And for the tool that you have at Dartmouth, did you go through that process or was it just very specific? This is really kind of insider stuff that like climate scientists like me are going to be using and that's what it's there for. I mean, did you go through a process on who could potentially benefit from this?
I think maybe it's helpful to kind of step back. When I pursue a science question, I'm motivated by the science question. A scientist, and so I'm not necessarily thinking about an end user. I'm not that applied. I think there's a gigantic gap between the science I do and the decision relevance of it. I think we're trending towards maybe becoming more decision relevant in our science here at Dartmouth. But I think that there's still a pretty big gap between science and decision making. But it's definitely like the case that I don't want one of the reasons that we make poor decisions in response to climate risks to be a lack of science. And so that is certainly a motivation that I have personally that informs the questions that I ask and the analyses that I pursue. So I write proposals, I get them funded sometimes if I'm lucky, and other times I don't. But in my group, we're kind of motivated by different sets of questions. What do climate impacts mean for people in particular places? And so we'll go and we'll do those analyses, and then we will go through the peer review process where we kind of take our results and we distill them into something meaningful that we think makes a contribution to our understanding of the world. And then we try to publish it. And so we do that through the peer review process. And the peer review process, I think, has its issues, but I think is also tremendously beneficial in that it tends to clarify the results and improve their robustness and their relevance to particular stakeholders. And then out of that, we will think about, okay, how do we furnish these data and code in a way that's legible to somebody who wasn't involved in the research. But yeah, it's often to a technical community, like our community of peers. And so we will, alongside with our publication, publish our code and our data such that a researcher from somewhere else can go in, download those data and code and replicate the results, ideally. It doesn't always work out that way. That's a huge amount of work, but that's a very much a goal we have. And I think in general, as a postdoc here at Dartmouth has documented in his own research, he has a preprint out there about the data transparency problem that climate has. And I was involved in a little bit of that work. And what Adam Pollock, this postdoc here, really does a great job of is documenting the extent to which minimal code openness and data standards are not being met by the climate science community, both private and public, and what that implies for our ability to move the science forward as rapidly as we have to. We need to get this stuff right because the stakes are real. And Adam lays out, I think, a really cogent set of data transparency and reproducibility goals that individual research groups like mine can sign on to and say, okay, these are the standards we as scholars are holding ourselves to in order to make our data a public good and publicly available. And that's kind of essential. If you were to go on my website for some of our papers that are kind of where I'm the senior author, these are kind of papers produced by my postdocs, led by my postdocs or graduate students, we publish the data and the code alongside of each of these projects. That said, I still think there's a huge gap between what I do and its relevance to any one decision anywhere.
Another bit of a transition here. You have some recommendations in that column too, and you talk about having a national adaptation plan. Why do you see value in that?
The national adaptation plan, there was a recent PCAST report. So that's the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, maybe. That sounds right. And they produced a really wonderful report last year that kind of lays out the necessity for a national adaptation plan. And I think the question is, for me, it's who furnishes the minimal informational requirements for adaptation, right? Where does that come from? Is it something that you, if you own a bakery in some city somewhere, right, and you're interested in understanding your flood risks or how temperature is going to change because, I don't know, that has some impact on how quickly your bread rises or how much climate control within your bakery you're going to need to invest in or whatever, right? I'm not sure. But where does that information come from? Who provides that information? Do you have to pay for it? I think that there should be, given that global warming is a collective tragedy, the information required to respond to it, whether you're an individual, so autonomous adaptations, or you're a municipality, that information should be a public good and it should be protected as such. And that means that a national adaptation plan would establish minimal informational requirements and make those data to inform adaptation decisions available to people in a legible format, right? I think, what does that look like practically? There's a lot of work going on in adaptation extension at the local scale, and a lot of offices like the USGS or I guess state climate offices as well have been doing a lot of work doing the translation of kind of coarse model output, like the stuff that I work with, to what it might imply for local scale decisions and communities. So you want to invest in a change in your storm drainage system at the municipal level such that it's robust to flood risks for the next century. What's the diameter of the sets of pipes you put in place? Well, that's got to be informed by the sets of climate risks that we understand to be forthcoming given our emissions of greenhouse gases. And there's a big disconnect there that you need a lot of data translation of bringing coarse projections down to the spatial and temporal scales that a decision about, yeah, like a combined sewer overflow pipe diameter might have to be if you're making that investment in a municipality. And so I think those folks have been trying to do that work. I think the question is, as we go forward, how much of the answers to those questions, how big should my pipe diameter be? To what extent do we outsource that to consultancies that do that translation? Or how much of that is provided in-house by the government? And so I think a national adaptation plan would clarify that, and it would have an adaptive management approach to a national adaptation plan, meaning that it would kind of take stock of evolving needs of the public as climate change and its impacts continue to unfold in order to alter its strategy. But the national adaptation plan, the details of it are myriad and complex. I think at a minimum, it would mean that you have a website available where you as an individual could just go to a website with a .gov domain and assess the sets of hazards that you face locally on various timescales through transparent data in a legible form, right? You'd be able to evaluate the risk of your home or your business or your family to heat waves or droughts or floods or tropical cyclone events, sea level rise. And those data and those risk assessments are linked back to kind of transparent and assiduous peer-reviewed science, right? And that you could do that process tracing where I want to know where this risk estimate came from or this range of risks that I face, where does that come from? And you'd be able to go back and do that documentation, and that those risk estimates would be updated as the science that provides those estimates improves. You'd be able to do that without inputting your credit card. Like, that to me is a minimal requirement. I think a national adaptation plan could extend further to maybe include, okay, well, given your risk profile, right, and the sets of hazards that you face locally, what kind of adaptation strategies should you pursue?
And what are the public resources available for you to pursue those adaptation strategies? I think that's another place where you could imagine a national adaptation plan being essential in both furnishing that information, right, and directing people to the sets of resources such that they can take steps to manage their risks. And I think that should be a public good, in my opinion.
Well, I did an episode where I had the author of the National Adaptation Plan in the Senate. He came on and they actually created some legislation, and there was some optimism that it would have bipartisan support, and it did, but they haven't really been able to attach it to anything, and it wouldn't really have much of a budget, but it'd be a first step. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but we're the only country in the world now, I think, with the last remaining couple, that we don't have a national adaptation plan. So there's demands for it, and it's a nice interface to actually communicate with other countries too. I don't know if anything, the Biden administration released a national resilience framework last fall. It's kind of wonky, and it's totally for kind of insider resilience folks. But they have, I think it's 6 or 8 objectives. And one of them does talk about resources and information and climate data, acknowledging that there's all these resources available and this needs to be available for local governments and such. Again, the resilience framework wasn't tied to any funding, but they're getting their thoughts together. And that, for a lot of us, a resilience framework, even the messaging, the name is horrible. Framework, a national adaptation plan is just, I think, much more direct, and it's a better communication tool independent of what's inside it. But they're making these steps in that right direction, but it's still kind of insider stuff. So there's movement there until you start attaching money to all these things, and it makes it not as serious.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I maybe the answer to this, Doug, but I wonder how much of that is tied to a lack of clarity about what a lead agency would look like, who would undertake the implementation of the National Adaptation Plan, who would own it, and therefore who would be responsible for its success or failure. I wonder if there's that clarity there. I'm not sure. And how that choice of agency would inform where kind of the public sector provision of information ends and where that's picked up by the private sector. You can imagine a scenario where a national adaptation plan is pursued and it's picked up maybe by an agency like NOAA, and they outsource the development of a lot of these tools to the private sector based on inscrutable models and inscrutable analyses that are not subjected to the same kind of scientific possibilities as open data. And so I just think that there's an alignment problem there, right? Private sector interests are not the public interest, even when the public sector is kind of an essential client to the private sector. I think about the fact that climate scientists at NCAR, at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, they're charged with developing models and tools to protect the public interest and to promote knowledge that everybody can use. But a climate scientist at Exxon, right, they're charged with creating profit, even if it means that they have to bury their own science about global warming for 30 years, all at the expense of the public. I just wonder who becomes the lead agency and where they determine private sector added value becomes the essential means to provide these data, how that system of power and profit shapes the product that we as the public get. And I think that's another issue.
Yeah, I started off my career in public sector, nonprofits, and a lot of people doing a lot of amazing work. But I tell you what, I'm being enticed by the darks. I'm not a private sector entity, but I deal with them a lot more than I did in a previous life. And it just that motivation, even if it's profit motivation, like most people in the private sector, they want to get some joy out of their lives that they're doing something positive and such. But the difference between the creativity, access to funding, all these things that elevate the private sector, that the conservation sector is that's where I worked for most of my career. It's bare bones funding. And so I think there's a lot of delusions going on and on ultimately what you can accomplish. And so that's why I'm intrigued by the private sector bringing its resources to bear in all these spaces. And again, there needs to be a lot of ethical conversation, like what you talked about in your column. We need to have these conversations, but we also need to elevate our game big time.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's an essential place for the private sector to be accelerating the lagging efforts in the public sector, right? And that's something I think the urgency that everyone feels in the face of the climate crisis is totally justified. And to the extent that informs a decision to pursue things rapidly
in the private sector, I think that's great. And I think that it's not as cut and dry as private sector bad, public sector good. I think it's more just how does incentivizing the development of climate risk information, the information we all need to adapt to climate change, how much does the commodification of that shape and reinforce haves and have-nots in our society? And what does that mean for the equity implications of global warming? That's something that I think about a lot just as a climate scientist. And I think those are hard questions that we need to be interrogating. I think the acceleration of solutions around climate in the private sector, that is clearly part and parcel with any kind of public sector efforts. And so I think of them as a constellation of approaches and not an either or. And that's what I'm hoping for.
You started this episode off talking a bit about your lab, but I like to ask professors, can you tell us a little bit about some of the work that your students are doing? I think you mentioned one or two, but do you feel like your students, are they just like they're these technical PhD students, or do you feel any of them like they're getting into the adaptation space? Is that sort of a conversation or a sense that you're getting with your own students?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I think about more about my student says, okay, are they technicians or are they scholars? And I think all of them are scholars, right? I think they're all fundamentally interested in improving our understanding of the world and with respect to this question of climate change. And I think they're all deeply motivated by a sense of urgency around the climate crisis and wanting to inform good decisions to manage it. The work that we're undertaking right now, there's a lot of it where I have one graduate student who's nearing completion of his PhD, Alex Gottlieb, who's just a really wonderful thinker. And it's been really fun to collaborate with him on questions related to attributing things like snow loss with global warming and what it implies for water availability in places like the American West and how that should inform adaptation. And in particular, we just actually had a paper come out in January where we essentially showed that the response of a location's snow to global warming is a function of what your average wintertime temperature is, and that it's highly nonlinear, meaning that a place in the American West may only lose 5% of its snowpack to the first degree of global warming, but it's going to lose about 30 or 40% to that second degree of warming. And that nonlinearity, I think, has important implications for informing adaptations. It implies that snow loss is not an emergency management kind of response where you're talking about declaring a disaster and getting a rapid injection of federal aid. Instead, it's that you have a rapid acceleration. And once you kind of move into this snow loss regime, it's not about managing a disaster. It's about managing a permanent change to your water supply portfolio. And so the adaptation versus emergency management kind of dichotomy, I think, gets really clarified there. You're really talking about the necessity for investing in water management adaptations that recognize that snow is not going to be a predictable part of your water supply portfolio, which has huge implications for a ton of places in the American West. I have other students thinking about more fundamental questions related to what the pattern of global warming implies for our ability so far. The spatial pattern of global warming so far implies about the projections of climate change that we get from our models and how that should inform our interpretation of the range of answers that a climate model gives for any one location on Earth. And then one of the big initiatives that we have going on right now is around this question of data poverty. And I have another student thinking about this deeply with me, where we're interested in documenting how data poverty on the geophysical side, so I'm literally talking like weather station observations, how that data poverty shapes our ability to document climate impacts in the most vulnerable places on Earth. And if you're just to look at a map of the spatial distribution of where we have weather observations, they are the province of the privileged, right? Like the ability to monitor your environment is itself a reflection of privilege, and data collection itself is a reflection of the values of the data collector. That has implications for our ability to assess climate impacts in places like sub-Saharan Africa. And it turns out that these data biases generated by the fact that we're just lacking weather station observations in these places means that we're least able to assess climate impacts in those places and therefore to develop meaningful strategies to manage those climate risks. And then one last project I'll mention is on informing loss and damage and climate liability. And so this is work that I led by Christopher Callahan, who is a PhD student who's now a postdoc at Stanford. We're really interested in this question of, can science inform loss and damage and climate liability conversations? And in particular, can we actually provide attributions, emitter-based attributions of climate damages? Meaning, can we say how much, say, Multnomah County in Oregon has been impacted by the 2021 heat wave, and how much that heat wave was generated by the emissions of a particular fossil fuel company? And we've developed a framework that I think become essential to informing these questions of in the climate accountability space and the data democratization space of how do we provide these data so that people can evaluate both their liability burdens or who they should be seeking to hold account for the consequences, the damages, and the harm that they've endured from these emissions as they've generated warming, and that warming has generated hazards, and those hazards have generated socioeconomic impacts.
Okay, final question, and I ask all my guests this, and don't forget, this is a climate adaptation podcast. If you could recommend one person to come on this show, who would it be?
Oh, gosh, such a good question, and I was woefully unprepared. I've learned about Madison Condon through you, actually, and just have been, I went back and I listened to her episode and just thought it was remarkable and just signaled to me how much farther along so many people, including Madison, happen to be on these things that I think about. And so I'd encourage everybody to go and listen to that. And I actually think there would be space for a second episode with her, just given the amount she knows.
I sort of love the idea that I've never had someone recommend a previous guest before. That's kind of funny on its face. So, I mean, we could leave it there.
No, I think a person I would suggest is, well, I'd suggest two, and they're both here at Dartmouth with me, and they've both instigated a lot of deep thinking for me about adaptation and how we pursue the energy transition in particular. And the first is Professor Aaron Mayfield, who is a professor in Thayer, which is the engineering school here at Dartmouth. She's just a really sharp mind, helping us think about how to pursue the energy transition, the modeling of it and the policies of it. And I think there are some important implications for the extent to which the overlap between what we think of as mitigation, this energy transition, and how it shapes adaptation, because the energy transition itself is going to be pursued in a world in which there is the impacts of global warming showing up and hurting our infrastructure. And to what extent is the energy transition itself kind of an adaptation exercise as well? And I think Aaron would be really good to kind of shed some insights there. The other person is Klaus Keller, who's also a professor at Thayer here. He has had a really amazing career in climate science, and Dartmouth has been fortunate to bring him in as a faculty here. And it's been great having him around. He's just a fun, brilliant mind, just fun to have a conversation with. And he is really at the forefront of robust decision-making under uncertainty. So how is it that we pursue adaptations that are beneficial under the broadest range of outcomes? And that strategy is hard to achieve. And Klaus is really wonderful because he's kind of got this background as a geoscientist and engineer and kind of a computational side, but he also deeply engages with stakeholder outreach and kind of actual decisions being taken by people and communities in response to climate risks, and is really interested in kind of connecting, really bridging that gap between science and decision making in a way that I can't imagine ever being equipped to do.
Okay, fantastic recommendations. I don't normally cover energy, but your point about her seeing the overlap with the transition with adaptation, that could be an interesting discussion. So great recommendations. And in Madison, I did say I'd probably reach back out to her at some point because I'm going to keep covering this topic. I said I was going to cover modeling and risk and all these things this in 2024. So it's a pattern I want to pursue. But Justin, this has been fantastic. I loved your column and I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun to chat with you.
Okay, adapters, that is a wrap. I love these types of discussions. Thanks to Justin for joining the podcast. He has done us all a service by bringing attention to the future use of climate data, most of which is generated by public tax dollars. As you heard from me, I think there's a huge role for the private sector in improving the delivery of this information to end users like local governments. And yes, we need to be aware of climate equity, meaning those who typically have difficulty funding these costly options. My own experiences in government leave me thinking there's a lot of work to be done to make publicly funding modeling tools more useful to adaptation end users. Many are clunky or not designed to be used at the scale of your typical adaptation planner. There needs to be processes that take into account ultimate end users of these tools. And I hope the private sector steps up and establishes some baseline ethical standards when it comes to the models and the software they create. If they're not careful, governments will step in and establish these standards for them. I'm not saying I'm against that either. It's still early. As I said before, we're in the wild, wild west of climate modeling. It's time to establish some standards in use and accessibility. Get on it, guys. And don't forget about the Waterfront Conference hosted by the Waterfront Alliance. It's May 21st in New York City. All right, before you go, if you are interested in having me speak at a public or corporate event, please reach out. I've been doing some keynote presentations. I was just in New Jersey giving the keynote address for their 2024 New Jersey Coastal and Climate Resilience Conference. That was a lot of fun. The theme was Adaptation, the Greatest Story Never Told. I share stories from the podcast and my own experiences in adaptation. It's also a pep talk about what we're all doing here. These are sobering times, but also very exciting times in the adaptation field. It's such a new emerging area that you can influence the field yourself. Let me help educate your audience on this emerging adaptation sector and how it differs from carbon mitigation and sustainability. Your companies and organizations, and especially your leadership, need to understand these differences in the years ahead. You can contact me at my website, americadaps.org. And imagine the potential of showcasing your achievements through a widely acclaimed podcast that boasts a large network of climate and adaptation professionals. Yes, I'm talking about America Adapts and how it offers your company or organization the perfect platform to tell your adaptation story and spread your message to a diverse and highly influential audience of climate professionals. By sponsoring a whole episode, you not only have the chance to share your story with the world, but also integrate a podcast episode into your organization's long-term communication strategy. It's time to expand beyond the confines of webinars and white papers, which can be often dry and forgettable. Let's work together to identify the experts who best represent the remarkable work your organization is undertaking in adaptation. This will not only enable effective communication with your members, board members, and funders, but also leave a lasting impact. The value of podcasts lies in their ability to continue promoting your story long after their initial release, ensuring it remains a critical educational resource for years to come. I am humbled to have collaborated with prestigious partners such as Battelle, the Department of Defense, NRDC, University of Pennsylvania Wharton, World Wildlife Fund, UCLA, Harvard University, the Trustees of Reservations, and many more. So let's add your organization to this esteemed list. Yes, we can make a difference in the world of climate change adaptation. Email me at americaadapts@gmail.com. Okay, adapters, keep up the great work. I'll see you next time.